welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words, with Billy Joel's Pressure fading out in the background. This is the episode of October 28th, 2021, the last episode in October. I hope you are having a wonderful autumn and that the weather's great and you're enjoying the outsides and the leaves falling, so all the regular stuff that we are so keen to enjoy in our autumns. I have a great show for you today. My guest is Martin Panek. He is the director of Liberální Institute in the Czech Republic, and we'll be talking about the Czech elections that happened recently and what is the future of current Prime Minister Andrej Babiš. Also in this episode, the Nutri-Score is being criticized by France's own agriculture minister. So that is very interesting because France was the first country to actually come up with the idea. I'm chatting to my colleague David Clement about PFAS chemicals and the whole controversy surrounding those. And a new survey in Germany shows that Germans are actually not really on board with the ban on fossil fuel cars. So let's get started. Let's first start with the Nutri-Score. So this is something that you might have heard about, especially if you live in France or Germany, because those countries have already introduced the Nutri-Score. This is basically a food labeling system. So on food items, you will see a Nutri-Score that ranges from the letters A to E or F, I'm not entirely sure, and they are color-coded as well, clearly indicating that A is supposed to be better than E or F. This label informs you about the nutritional value of that product. The problem, of course, being that nutritional value can be confused by consumers with the healthiness of the food. A schnitzel and a Coca-Cola, which is two products I've given as an example to illustrate how I think this label is misleading, would be very nutritious, both of them. But of course, we shouldn't understand from this that they are healthy necessarily. The more you eat of them, of course, the more nutrition you would get from them, and that's why you feel full if you eat a lot of them. But of course, that is misleading. That unfortunately is not the reason why France is criticizing the Nutri-Score. The French Minister for Agriculture, who's actually on many topics, especially like neonicotinoids and pesticides and all that, he's not too bad. Julien de Normandie, he has called for a review of the methodology of the traffic light labels. And he says that he wants to make sure it doesn't penalize certain traditional French products, such as fatty and salty cheeses. Very interesting. This is also from the Politico newsletter. It says, the Nutri-Score has been adopted by a number of EU producers, retailers, and governments, becoming a leading nutrition label across the bloc and a top potential option for realizing Brussels' plans for a mandatory EU-wide system. However, the way Nutri-Score rates traditional fatty, salty foods poorly has made it unpopular in places like Italy, which has been campaigning against its wider adoption. It seems similar concerns have cropped up now in its home country of France. Very interesting there. They seem to now be opposing the Nutri-Score, even though they came up with it, and for all the wrong reasons. I don't mind the Nutri-Score not becoming mandatory because I don't think the Nutri-Score is a good system. But I'm not entirely sure the reasons they give here are the best ones. It shouldn't really be about whether Italian cheeses or French cheeses ought to be protected because the Nutri-Score would discriminate against them. It's that the label in itself is quite nonsensical. It tells you very little about the products because, you know, like the reason we go into a supermarket and buy food is, of course, to get nutrition in the first place, but it's when we look at the products and the information we get from the products, it's the nutritional value we always have kind of identified for ourselves with our regular diet anyway. You know, I know how how full I'll feel after certain meals because I know myself and I had many of these meals. What I'm usually would be interested in more is sort of information about the fat content, the sugar content, and that's already available anyway. So the Nutri-Score adds very little but confusion to the entire debate. And well, at least I'm glad that the Nutri-Score now seems to be facing some opposition, even though it is not for the exact right reasons. In other news then, I recorded an interview with my colleague David Clement. He's the North American Affairs Manager at the Consumer Choice Center, and we talked about PFAS chemicals. They've been in the news recently, so here's what we talked about.
So David, you've recently started looking at PFAS. So PFAS seems to be these chemical substances that people are increasingly talking about. I even saw this video from John Oliver, the comedy show host, who talked about it on his HBO show. What is there to know about?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. So the conversation about PFAS really developed, in my opinion, with a movie. It's called Dark Waters. And it was essentially about dumping, which I think everyone can be opposed to. It was the dumping of a particular chemical into water sources, and it was making people sick. And the reaction, at least over the last 3 or 4 years, has been essentially to try and ban almost 5,000 of these chemicals, some of which are probably deserving of being heavily restricted, but some of them aren't, because it really depends on how they're used. And that's really what I was looking at is, these chemicals are used in very important medical technologies. They're used in how a smartphone is produced. The list is actually much longer than just those two examples. And so if we're looking at PFAS, yes, I think we have to look at it from a clean drinking water perspective. You can't be dumping waste or having that externality kind of leak over to a point where it's contaminating water sources. I think everyone should be on board with that. But at the same time, you can't go the other way and go 100% to a full ban, because you really eliminate the usefulness of these chemicals in ways, when they're used in ways that don't really threaten your health. So the using these chemicals to produce smartphones is not equivalent to putting it in waterways. And we have to have policy that finds a difference between the two and then legislates based on that difference.
But for all the uses of these chemicals, it should be apparent to people that banning all of them altogether would constitute considerable problems. Why are they not seeing that that this problem could arise if we banned all of PFAS chemicals?
I think they have the horse blinders on. I mean, it's very similar to the plastic debate, where it's like, no, the sea turtles, we have to get rid of all the plastic. And then they'll say that it's good for the environment, but then obviously there are examples of when it's not. It's this very single-minded viewpoint where if something is potentially bad, we must get rid of it forever. And it's important to look at the externalities. What's the cost? What's the cost-benefit analysis? And there are some legitimate uses that I think need to be defended. I mean, look at medical supplies and care. It's very important that your heart patch has certain qualities to it to ensure that it does its purpose. And so, they just seem to be blind. It's a blind spot for the activists who are very much opposed to PFAS, because in their mind, they can't see any rational justification for ever using it. But in my opinion, they're largely ignorant as to how widely it is used in ways that are not harmful to your health.
So you recently wrote this piece also in response to the John Oliver segment. Give us some over the top takeaways that you had in that piece as to how John Oliver got it wrong when it comes to PFAS.
So he got it wrong in the sense that he framed the debate. It was almost as if he was, if the show was hosted in the late 90s. So he was talking about PFAS and problematic water contamination and things like that. So, I mean, first off, all of the numbers pretty much across the board are down, whether it's mean blood levels or the prevalence that's found in water. Like, all of these things that would be concerning have gone down considerably in the 70 to 80% range since the year 2000. And so largely, the problem is being solved. Now, it's not perfect. So he's making the case to basically just blanket ban, blanket classify everything as hazardous, despite the fact that everything is going down, which really leads me to the conclusion that for the most part, these chemicals are being phased out from some of their more trivial use, where they may have been convenient, but there were some serious problems in regards to harms. And so, I mean, that's the first big one. And then the second is just forgetting that it is used in a variety of products that people need and want, not just the ones that he used. I mean, he talks about raincoats and Teflon pans and things like that, which make it all seem quite trivial, and a consumer could probably watch that video and go, okay, well, maybe I don't need that pan. I can go without or use a different product. And that's totally fine. But when we're talking about the production process for smartphones and whether they overheat or not, or we're talking about very important medical devices, it's a lot more nuanced than that. And so, I mean, I don't expect him to be able to have nuance. He's a comedian and a late night talk show host. Nuance is not particularly his forte, but that's really where we're at in regards to his rant.
David, thanks so much. And talking about nuance, you also have a lot of that in your newest paper at the Consumer Choice Center. One size does not fit all. You can find it under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
In other news then, Germans don't seem to be backing the fossil fuel phase out of car production. So as you might know, by 2030, German governments have considered to phase out the internal combustion engine, which means that no petrol and diesel powered cars will be allowed to be sold anymore. The motorist organization ADAC did a survey. 54% of respondents said they opposed the measure, while just 21% said they were in favor. Promoting climate neutral fuels for internal combustion engines was supported by 57%. Not entirely clear exactly what is meant by that, because there are the different additives we already have, the E5, the E10. But of course, they also have their own environmental considerations, and this is actually something we can get into in the future. Very interesting there is that this is so fairly strongly rejected, also because there's already been plans for rules for that at the EU level. So let me just play this clip from Reuters.
The EU proposed an effective ban on the sale of new petrol and diesel cars as of 2035 as part of a broader package of measures on climate change. The European Commission proposed a 55% cut in CO2 emissions from cars by 2030 versus 2021 levels, and then a 100% cut by 2035, which would make it impossible to sell new fossil fuel-powered vehicles in the bloc. To boost EV sales, Brussels also proposed legislation that would require countries to install public charging points along major roads by 2025. The Commission proposals will need to be negotiated and approved by EU member states and the European Parliament, which could take around 2 years.
You know, look, we've talked about this quite a bit on this podcast already. If we want to go to all electric mobility, we need the necessary infrastructure, and that's not available right now. It's also increasing considerable costs on many people, and also employment opportunities that will significantly change. It will also increase our necessity for electricity, which means that we need a grid that can support all of this. And given the current electricity prices and natural gas prices, I'm not really sure that this phase out is the wisest thing to do. I don't think that this German survey here is bad news. I actually think it gives us some food for thought to maybe reconsider these timelines, because just by banning something is not how we get to the ultimate production levels that the government would like us to have. This is the general rule. If the government sets a target, and the target can be reached by the private sector anyway by a certain timeline, then it will be reached, because consumers are demanding alternative mobility options anyway. And if it cannot be reached, then the rules and the restrictions and the goals are completely useless in the first place, because what are you going to do? Are you going to just tax all the manufacturers into oblivion just because they haven't met the targets there? I don't think that makes much sense either, and I don't think it's going to happen. But now let's move to the interview of the week. My guest this week is Martin Panek. He is the director of Liberální Institute in the Czech Republic, and we talked about the Czech elections, what happens in the future, and what he sees as the top priorities for the Czech Republic going forward. So, of course, we wanted to talk to you about the Czech Republic and the recent elections that took place, which seems to have changed quite a few things, but of course a lot of our listeners are not entirely involved in the politics of the Czech Republic. So give us a bit of an overview. What happened exactly in those elections, and what political situation are we looking at right now?
So for the last 4 years, we've had this infamous prime minister by the name of Andrej Babiš. And he had a coalition government with the Social Democrats. That was an explicit taking part on the part of the Social Democrats and the communists as well. But that was not explicit. The Communist Party was not part officially of the government. And so it was like 50-50 if in the election this coalition will carry the majority again. But unfortunately for them, Babiš took more of their votes than was necessary, and they failed to meet the 5% threshold. There was another party that almost got 5%. It was thought to be supportive of Babiš, but it also got only like 4.7%, so it didn't get over the threshold. And the end result of that is that Babiš cannot carry a majority in the House, it seems, for now at least, unless he convinces one of the opposition parties, then there is no chance for him to form a government with a majority in the House.
And so, does the opposition currently have a path for a coalition group that could get together, or is that still unclear for the moment?
There were five opposition parties that created two coalitions that ran together. So, in one of the coalitions, it was more of a conservative one, where the traditional civic democrats who were in the government multiple times here, and also the Catholics, and one of the newer parties, which is actually now 12 years old, but nevertheless. And then there was a more of a progressive coalition with pirates and mayors. So it's called Pirates and Mayors. And those are two parties. One is the Pirate Party, and the other party is the Mayors and Independents. And so these five parties formed two blocks that ran, and they promised to form the future government together. Now, they have a majority of, I think, 109 out of 200, so it should be quite easy for them to form the government. The problem, of course, is that this is too many parties, and they actually don't need one of the parties because it only has four MPs now. So we will see how exactly the government can form. And there's an additional problem of the not very alive president.
Yeah, so talk to us about that. He seems to be in very ill health, but as far as I can imagine, the position of a president is that he's needed in order to, you know, to lead the transition of government. So what is happening there?
So the president's power is to name a prime minister and name a government. And if we don't have a president, then the constitution carries those powers to the prime minister or to the president of the house. But when we have a president who is not responsive, then it gets more tricky. And because he hasn't vacated the office, of course. So now what to do? He has to actively do things like name the prime minister, name the new government and stuff. And currently he seems to be not, very, very not capable of doing that. There is a provision how the parliament can temporarily strip him of the office of the president. But of course, there are people saying you should not do that. He's still living and all that sort of stuff. But we have now until the 8th of November at least to see any developments, if he gets better or not. I don't think it's very likely that he would get better. His health has been deteriorating for years, and he's not been responsive for months now, basically. So I don't see his way out of this, actually. But we'll see.
And so what does this mean for Mr. Babiš if he doesn't end up being prime minister? Again, with all the investigations into fraud and corruption, does that strip him of immunity, which could then get him into judicial problems in the Czech Republic? Or don't you think, or do you think that would actually not be an option right now?
Right. So his immunity was waived twice already by two previous parliaments. His immunity will need to be waived again by this new parliament, because he has a new mandate as an MP, and of course the majority will waive the immunity for him, but of course he can be issued a pardon by the president if he comes to his abilities, or if the office of the president is vacated, this power actually transfers to the prime minister, which is still Babiš, and he can probably pardon himself. He can definitely pardon his wife and his associates. So this is a constitutionally probably funny thing, but this is where we are. He still has the government until well into November, if we think that he will not do that, or the president will not do that, then the parliament will, of course, waive his immunity, and he will be maybe someday in court. This has been going on for 5 years now. It's been taking incredibly long, and currently the bookmakers think that he has the best chance of becoming the next president if the office actually vacates. So then he would get another immunity that is not waivable. You cannot waive the immunity of the president. So
wow,
that's another complication.
Wow, I mean, there's a lot of back and forth going on there. What actually happens if Miloš Zeman, the current president, says, like, I'm too sick, I gotta stop, I resign? Who becomes president? Do you need to vote again?
Yeah, so for the last two terms, we've had the direct election of the president, and the election would need to take place within 90 days. So it's very, very quick. Probably not enough time for people to gather. You need to have 50,000 signatures from the people to run, or 10 senators or 20 MPs. So probably there will not be enough time for the 50,000 from the people. And we will have only people who can have some backing by the senators or MPs. And so, as I said, the powers transfer to the prime minister and to the president of the house. And so constitutionally, that's not a big problem. It's more of a problem with the personalities. And of course, it's bizarre that this is happening simultaneously, that the president is incapable of discharging his duties, and there's an election and a change of government, dramatic change, like for the opposition becomes the government. It's very bizarre and rare, probably. And but of course the important lesson I think here is that he should not have run in the last election, because his health was very bad at that time as well, and it was obvious that something like this was quite likely to happen. And this is the, I would say, the duty of his associates and of his own and of his voters, not to do this kind of stupid thing. Because I mean, he has been president, but he has not been very active because his health is really bad for the last 4 years at least.
Explain to us in this election how exactly the opposition was able to gather more attention there, because there's been a lot of protests in the Czech Republic over the last few years. What explained this phenomenon that that the opposition has been able to gather some sort of alternative coalition majority. Is it really just that Babiš took too many votes from potential allies, or was there also, I don't know, more youth voter turnout, more turnout in the big cities, or less turnout in the villages? Do we have any numbers on that?
So there was the highest turnout since, I think, the 1990s. So this election was perceived as very high stakes. And the smaller parties that are in the opposition did the logical thing to form blocks together so that the voters would not think that one of the parties will not get over the 5% hurdle. And in both of these blocks, there were parties at risk of not clearing that hurdle. And this had a big payoff because Babiš didn't do it. He could have formed a bloc with the Social Democrats or the Communists, and he would still have majority had he done that. But this was a miscalculation, I think, on his part, because if you count the votes, even for the parties that did not clear the hurdle, then of course he would have a majority. But this was really illogical on his part that he took too many voters from them and he didn't include them on his candidates list or in his voting running block. So this was a strategic mistake on his part. And we had this movement called Million Moments for Democracy, that had huge crowds at the rallies, and a lot of people say that this pushed the parties to form the blocs and to actually work together against the threat, or against the, again, probably unusual thing that we have a prosecuted prime minister. I thought we were the only country that did that, but I was somebody told me that actually Israel already had a prime minister who was being prosecuted, so we're not the first, but it's still a rarity, I think, in world's politics.
It most certainly is. Now, as it seems, as I hear from you, it is possible that in 2022 we will not have a Prime Minister Babiš anymore. And so what do you think does that mean for the Czech Republic's place in Europe? Right now, when the Czech Republic works together in coalition with other countries in the European Council, it's very often the V4, and the V4 with their own rule of law complications and difficulties, conflicts in the European Union. How do you see the place of a Czech Republic that is now possibly governed by the opposition? Do you think it will change course, or in order to secure a more long-term voter base, it needs to kind of steady the line on what Babiš's policies were in the European Union?
So the future Prime Minister, Petr Fiala, is actually a political scientist, and he wrote this very thick textbook on the European Union. So, sorry. Yeah, and so he certainly understands how the EU operates and how it works, and he has been in politics pretty long now. He previously was a minister for education, and I don't think very much changes with respect to our position in the European Union. The government is always pro EU, even Babiš, even when they even in his capacity of defrauding the EU of its funds, which is one of the charges against him, he always was pro EU. Well, one of the reasons is that he gets a lot of money from the legislation that the EU passes. Now, of course, the situation will be probably a little different in the way that Messrs. Orbán and Morawiecki, I think, are maybe closer to Babiš than to Fiala, but he's a good politician and a good diplomat. I'm sure he will find a common ground with our neighbors and partners in the V4s, as they always say. And I don't think there will be much change. There's also, of course, the Czech presidency of the EU next year, which we are all looking forward to. And I don't think there will be many changes, because it's the way it is. We always do what the EU suggests. So there's not very much opposition from our country in the council. So.
Martin Panek, we're getting to the end of the segment. You at Liberalny Institute, you talk a lot about reforms that the country needs, and I didn't want to send you off without asking you about the necessary reforms that you think a future government will have to embark on. We don't have too much time left, but if you had to identify, in your view, in short words, the top priorities that you would see that the Czech Republic is facing. Last week, we talked to Franz Schellhorn. He said, for Austria, it's definitely the pension system. There's this redistributive pension system where old people get more and more funds, and the calculation doesn't work. For the Czech Republic, what would you identify economically, politically, budgetary, as like the number one priority that, if a government were to be serious about reforms, would have to embark on?
Well, the pension system would be a good choice, but it's not going to get reformed. That's just not happening. We now have very large fiscal deficits that they're so enormously large that this needs to be cut down. There are reforms to be made in the tax system, in deregulation. Even the Ministry of the Economy says we need to deregulate some of the things. There are things that the Babiš government introduced and probably need to be undone, like the electronic evidence of revenues and stuff like this. I think they will not run out of ideas to reform positively, but I'm not holding my breath that many things are actually going to get done, but we'll see.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Martin Panek on Twitter at mmister, and of course follow the Consumer Choice Center as well at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words. See you Thursday.
You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only